Sorry, Dustin. Yeah. Sorry in advance. Welcome to New Game Plus. You're listening to a retro gaming podcast where three guys spend 7 days playing one old game and then we talk about it. I'm Nolan.
I'm Kenny.
And Dustin ain't here.
If you couldn't tell.
Yeah, if you couldn't tell, he has literally done all 200 and whatever of those intros. But today it's just going to be Nolan and Kenny, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, you can't give Dustin too hard of a time. He is literally out of the country, so it wasn't a great option for him to join us this week. But we'll miss him like crazy, and probably have a better show without him anyways.
Ooh, I was thinking the opposite, but I like that attitude. This is episode 216.
It's a lot of episodes.
I guess.
So let's talk about some things that have happened in gaming this week. A whole boatload of big popular titles have been delayed in their releases.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, most notably, the next big title game from the developers of Witcher 3.
CD Projekt Red.
Yep.
Yeah.
Who's coming out with Cyberpunk 2077.
Mm-hmm.
Been lots of hype ever since they announced the game way back in like 2012.
Oh, really? Did they announce it back then?
Before they even started development on it, they knew kind of generally what they were doing and knew that once they were like done with heavy development of the Witcher series, that's what they were going to do. Anyhow, it was slated to be released in April, and people were starting to get pumped. And then just this week, they dropped a letter to the community saying, basically, hey, we want to make sure this game is super polished and perfect, and we think it's – they literally refer to it as – they think it's going to be their crowning achievement for this generation of gaming. And so they want it to basically be flawless. And so they said, we need more time. We want to play test. We want to fix it. We want to polish it. Like, it's done, but it's not quite there. And so you get to wait 5 more months.
Do you know how much I respect them for that announcement?
Yeah.
I'm not bummed at all.
And they've done that before.
With Witcher 3?
I believe, also got bumped a few times for just additional polish. And I'm totally with you. I brought this up as the topic of conversation just because I wanted to like actually get really hyped about that fact. I just hate how often games anymore just get shipped, like ship it fast, ship it early access, start monetizing it right away, we'll fix it later. And
the Assassin's Creed syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just so unfortunate.
If they really have that opinion about and that prediction that Cyberpunk is going to be their like next thing and it's going to be a really, really major thing, I do not blame them at all for wanting to make it perfect for the player, because they've probably learned from those other companies that failed because they just publish without playtesting. Please do that.
And these games are so big, the amount of work it takes to they're not going to ship a bug-free game, but they want to get as close as they can. And the amount of time it takes to do that is crazy. I have a suspicion that, and other people have said this as I was reading about this news this week, but I think it's right, that because of some of the hype from Witcher dropping on Switch, which I think happened relatively recently, as well as people going back and playing and or purchasing the game because of the Netflix series, that it actually gave them a little bit of a monetary injection to like buy them time for this huge team. They're running like a 500 man team on this project or something.
Right.
So delaying that 5 months, like that's serious news.
They had to call Keanu back in to re-record his right? speaking bits. No, that's a good point. I didn't think about that because it actually caused me to go and buy The Witcher books. So it's a little different, but you're probably 100%
right. We're going to end up doing the same thing. We just started, my wife and I just started watching the Netflix series.
Me too.
Last night.
What, me too. Or do you really? Like it?
That's crazy.
Yes, literally last night started, and yep, I so am halfway done with the first book.
What? Oh, you started reading the book.
Yeah.
Oh, we started watching the TV series.
No, I did too.
Oh, you did both. And the book as well. Okay.
Yeah.
I was confused. Yeah. no, my wife's a huge reader. She's planning on getting the books, hasn't yet. And we just started watching the series last night. And so
nice.
I'm sure everyone has gotten hyped. And I'm sure it's nice to be the developer who is at the place where the game's done and it's got momentum. They got themselves a little bit of extra time. And now they just have to sort of play test. You know, like that's yeah. hard work, but the main development is done. So it's all downhill from here for them.
I just caught like it. I was, yeah.
In our Go retro ahead. Game of the week. Marble Madness.
Overview.
Marble Madness is a puzzle platformer arcade game. It was published by Atari in 1984. It's an old game. It was developed by Atari, but more accurately, it was the brainchild of Mark Cerny, who designed and programmed the game. I almost feel like it's a little unfair to say Atari developed it, because this guy is really the one responsible for it. So let's pause. If you don't know Mark Cerny, let me help you. He is the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Game Developers Association. He was inducted into the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. He's been an executive at Sony since the 90s, and most recently was the lead architect for the PlayStation 4, and I'm assuming somewhat, if not totally, involved with the upcoming PS5. He most recently was the technical producer for a game you may have played, Death Stranding. So wow. He's quite the figure in gaming. Have you heard of him, Kenny?
I have now. The name actually well, really good. Did sound familiar, but I couldn't have told you like specifically his role. But when you go back and read some of these early influential game developers, it is not uncommon to see a lot of them sort of, at least those that, you know, had big successful games, to go on and become big household names in the gaming industry. Because that's for those that made it. I mean, this was a 1984 game. This is right after. Yeah. You know, the giant game crisis of 83.
Yeah, the and E.T. so, thing.
Yeah, this making a big, successful Atari arcade cabinet, like, was a big deal for them at this point.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm proud of this guy. I didn't know who he was. But in reading about the game and researching, I'm like, I love this guy, and I didn't even know it, because he was probably responsible for a lot of really cool stuff that we enjoy, like games, and like his gamography is actually pretty long. Death Stranding, I just read, was the most recent, but he's produced several other Sony games, or, you know, games for the PlayStation, so pretty cool guy. And yeah, he made Marble Madness. So back to this game. This was a game of firsts. It was the first to use Atari's, at the time, it was new hardware in their arcade cabinets. It was one of the first games written completely in C, programming language. And it was one of the first to have stereo sound capabilities, which was new to video games in the industry at that time. So actually, like, surprisingly, this game made quite a few big strides in gaming in general. So I thought that was kind of impressive. You, the player, control a marble through an isometric stage of angled slopes and obstacles. It's very important to note that it's isometric, or else you would not be able to get that 3D illusion that it has. That obviously wasn't 3D then, but the art style is very, very like Tron-esque in my mind. and adds a lot to the depth of the game, which will be a major talking point for us, I'm sure, as we're going through this. But think, and maybe you haven't played this, Kenny, I don't think you have, but this Super game? Monkey Ball.
Oh, Super Monkey Ball. I was like, yeah, I've played Marvel Madness.
No, you just skipped this week. Super Monkey Ball is GameCube, was first a GameCube game, and there have been sequels, but it's very, very influenced by Marble Madness. That's the best like image I can give you to think about what this game plays like, or what the goal is at least. So the goal is you get the marble.
Super Monkey Ball though is like actually 3D. This is
sure
faux 3D way earlier than that, and you know, not nearly the complexity of those
yes.
kind of puzzles. It's a relatively short game.
It's a short game, but it's the same style. You are the marble, right. and you're having to get through these obstacles to get to the end of the level, the goal. So it's usually you're starting at the top, and you're kind of making your way down. It's got some pinball vibes to it. It's a very unique game, I think, especially for the 80s.
Yeah, I think it's unique, not just for, I don't know, the type of game, which was new and novel. Like, this is the first of this. He lets roll a ball and get it somewhere as part of a like platforming puzzle type game. It really was a genre yeah. definer, but yeah. it was also unique in that the original arcade cab is it's not a joystick. I mean, there were other games that also did this, but this is a trackball game. So when you're yes. playing it on real original hardware, this ball that is falling that you're moving, you're doing with a trackball, which is super nice. Because you don't have to just go up, down, left, right. Like, you've got a ton of control over direction and speed and the ability to stop the ball and back up the ball. And I think it's super important yeah. to remember that vibe when we talk about this game, because for ease, I don't think a lot of us have a trackball just like sitting around.
Yeah.
And so we probably all played it on, you know, on a D-pad or a keyboard or yeah. whatever, you know, normal directional buttons you have. But I think remembering that is super important to this game.
Yes.
Gameplay.
I'm glad you brought that up, Kenny. Starting the gameplay here, I think that it is very important to keep that in mind. And I just want to go ahead and talk about it because I think it's the thing about this game that either adds to the experience or might shift your experience very seriously. So the mm-hmm. controls. The arcade Atari original version had that trackball. And I mean, if I'm understanding, I didn't look it up, like what it looked like, but Kenny, you'll have to help me. If I understand, it's like a trackball mouse, but like it's just a ball and you're rolling it around.
Yeah,
like,
if you ever played, I'm trying to think, probably the most well-known arcade games that are trackball that I think of at least are golf games. Because you have that like ball sitting there and you like spin it real hard. Maybe it's just because the only place I see arcade cabinets anymore these days is like, I don't know, truck stops. And those are the yeah. games that people want to play.
And they like golf. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But when I think of trackball, I think of like golf titles. But it's those games that just have the big ball that sort of sticks up out of the, you know, out of the console, and you're able to manipulate it in any direction because it's just a ball.
Yes. Yeah, it's just a ball, and it's almost like you have absolute control in this game with that. And that means we did not get to use the trackball controls. We played on a pad because we played the NES port. This game was ported. I didn't mention it. This game was ported to like everything back then, like Apple II, to the Atari home consoles, to the Commodore 64.
It was on and a Game the Boy NES. System.
Yeah, like everything. It was very successful. I mean, obviously, they spent money on porting it. And the NES version was the home console version, I think, standard, what people would say is like the most successful one, just because that platform was popular. And you were using a D-pad to control the ball here. And unlike normal platformers, right, in those games you have the D-pad and you're moving around, but you're also using the other buttons to shoot or jump. And in this game, it's almost entirely, with one exception, about the D-pad and moving around. And I think it affected maybe some of our experience this week. So I just wanted to get that out there so that everyone knows that maybe if we're bashing the controls at any point or praising them, that it could have been different on the arcade.
Yeah, I will say they were nice to give you two control options. When you load up game and jump into it, you can kind of set the – I don't really know how to explain it because it's a little confusing on the field.
It's
but
you so
can basically
hard to
set
explain.
The orientation of like your D-pad. So the default is sort of you move the ball based on like the 90 degrees that you're seeing. So like up is up, right is right.
Yeah.
But then the layout of the grid has a lot of areas that are sort of at 45 degree angles. So you can kind of change your mouse input to be at a 45 degree angle instead of a 90 degree angle, which lets you sort of go like up and to the right or up and to the left. Down left,
it's like,
and down right. It's basically like if you took your D-pad and turned it 45
yes,
degrees.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Instead of a plus, make your D-pad an X.
Exactly.
And then that's the controls. It's not good. I didn't like it. I use 90 degrees.
Used to a D-pad and what it means with our normal orientation.
Yeah.
I feel like you would have to have had a really good reason to do that or something. But when you see the way the levels lay out and the way your ball moves and a lot of the motion sort of happening on diagonal lines, I can see why they would think to offer that as an option. I don't think anyone going back and playing this as like a retro game is going to default to at least right away using that and enjoying it more than 90 degrees.
Yeah. So the controls there obviously being important because the whole point of this game is movement. And I think that's a good place for us to talk about what we're actually moving around and doing. And along with that, the difficulty of this game comes into play. So this game's no joke. It ramps up.
It ramps up really hard. But it needs to because it's only six levels the entire game. And again, remember, this is designed as an arcade title first. And so the point is, let's eat people's quarters. I mean, literally, games are designed around that. And so if you're doing a credit-based system where, like, if you die and want to continue, you got to stick another quarter in, you're talking about a game that is made to be difficult.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. You brought that up. The six stages. That's not a lot. These stages aren't long, by the way. They're very short. And six, you might think, okay, well, this isn't a game. This is a short story game. Like, where's the rest of the game I paid for? But no, like, he meant for it to be that brief, but it's not, one and done. You're going to lose all your quarters playing this game. Like,
I'm sure in a world where, like, hardware was better than it was in 1984, they would have released the same game with 20 levels. You know, like, there's tons of ability for them to have made more levels out of it. But there's just limitations there on what you can get. And so because of that, they take you through a brief tutorial that kind of, like, is really easy. You just sort of go down this slope, learn how the, you know, sort of 3D terrain that you're on affects your ball, learn how if you fall off the edge, you die, all the normal kind of like learning curve things, and then get to the end of the level and no consequences there. You're just learning. But then after that, it's high stakes because the way the game works is you're trying to get through each level, but even the early levels, you need to get through as quick as you possibly can, because when you finish the level, when you get the marble all the way through this puzzle course and around obstacles and figure out the clues and figure out the fastest route and go through these little flags that mark you being at the end, you're given a bonus for how quickly you complete it. And any leftover time that you have then carries over to your next level.
I love that.
If you don't complete the early levels quickly, by the time you get to the hard levels, it could be literally impossible for you to have enough time to navigate all the way through them.
It's a very, very smart way to make this game feel cohesive. Like, and with it only being six stages, like I don't really know of any games that give you the better you perform early on, the better or the easier the later part of the game is going to be. I can't name you too many games like that. And so I'm like, hats off to Mark here for even thinking of that being a mechanic.
And they were smart enough to make this a very point driven game, which is not surprising with it being arcade, but because it's so short, part of the appeal is, can you beat this game? Like, there's the challenge of, hey, stick in a quarter, see if you can make it all the way through. But part of the appeal is, hey, can you hit that top 10 leaderboard? You know, can your name get up at the top and you come back to it? And so even though it's relatively short, and I think the game didn't have as much longevity as some other arcade titles that were released that did have more complexity. Like, it still had this replayability because you're not just beating the levels, but you're beating the levels in your best time, and each level ends up mattering. And so it's a game that if you want to be really successful at, even though it's short, you're going to have to like master it. You're going to have to play it again and again and figure some stuff out.
And shout outs to them for allowing you to put in full words instead of just three letters, your initials for the leaderboards.
For
real. Put like poop and fart and stuff. Okay, back to the difficulty, because like you said, you're going to be playing this a lot. The way that the reason this game is so difficult, there's so many things. Obstacles, right? So you have slopes, you have corners, you have gaps. And they make you time your movements at times and think about what to do next. It's not just it's not always super linear. Overall, it's yes, go from the top to the bottom is one way to look at it. But it zigzags along the way. And so it's not just a simple, I don't know, go left and right and down. The next thing that makes it challenging, there are enemies. So you have slimes that you can just die if you touch them. You have these suction worm things that are actually really terrifying that jump in the air and fall down on you, like to eat you. And then other marbles rolling around just as an obstacle to get around. But then, and you mentioned it a little bit, the time. There's a countdown going on at the top of the screen. And yeah, so if you beat it quickly, that leftover time goes to the next. But the stress that clock ticking down adds to this game makes it harder. I really think it's a psychological thing that makes the player make bad decisions, and it's brilliant.
Right. It's this balance of like, I want to go as fast as I possibly can, but that gets really reckless because then the odds of you falling off or missing the timing of one of these interactions or running into an enemy, it just the difficulty ramps the faster you try and go. And so it's great because you can like meander your way through it and you're going to feel relatively successful at the early levels. And then, man, you don't have a lot of time left and these harder levels are going to just destroy you. But then as you get better at the game, you can go faster. But it's like the difficulty automatically scales with how hard you're trying to play.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a great mechanic for sure.
And then finally, I think one of the other difficulty factors here is, and I usually we save this for the age section most of the time, so forgive me, but I think it's relevant to gameplay. The music adds more stress, which adds to the difficulty more. So the soundtrack is kind of like stressful. I don't know. There's like an urgency to it.
They intentionally add this like energetic countdowny kind of like, you've got to get to the end of this track. That's so wise when you're doing a game like this, because it does. It pulls people in and makes them feel like they're really having something to compete against.
It was praised for difficulty back then, apparently. And I can see why after talking. If you break it down like that and you kind of think of all the things that are added to this game to make it just like a rush to the end. Yeah, it's brilliant. I'm on board with the difficulty.
It'd be super easy to talk about this game as like as NES hard because, you know, there's sort of a thing there.
Sure.
But like I think arcade hard is almost another level. Like these games were trying to make you feel like you could do them, but then they wanted you not to succeed, or they wanted you to have to play a whole lot to be successful. And that's like, that's game design philosophy. That's how they actually made their money. And so to some degree, like successful games today, you want to make a lot of money. You hook players in by giving away a free game, and then you slowly drain their wallets by like releasing cosmetics. DLC and cosmetics. Yeah. Like that's
put the, a hat on your
successful, exactly. That's the successful milk people's wallets. These games were make a game that looks easy, that's fun, that's challenging, that feels like it can be beaten really quickly, but that is super hard in actuality because we want those quarters to go in again and again and again. And this game nailed it on that front. It is, it's hard. And
did you beat it?
I mean, yes, but like
you had to have.
It's short enough, and we can play with save states. I will say, if I wasn't using save states, if I had to do a all the way through flawless, you know, game and succeed without dying, like I'd just be dead. Like I wouldn't be able to beat this game. It's
you can
hard.
Do it. I did it, but let me tell you, it took me several tries.
Yeah, but like right now, I had to master.
Sure. I had to master the first three stages, and that third stage is ridiculous.
It's so like, hard.
It goes from being like, all right, that's a little challenging to like, that's impossible.
Yeah.
What? And to do it quickly. Yeah. Okay. We've established the game's hard, but it's a good hard in my opinion. I think it's a good challenge.
It's a great hard. And one other feature of this game we haven't talked about that I think we should is they designed this game not just to be single player, but to have a multiplayer option.
Yeah, so like you could, what?
Right, that's crazy. So you could play head-to-head against your friends. Now, that sounds kind of like a nightmare, but they were super smart about giving you different routes to go down so that people didn't have to kind of like share the same space if they chose not to. And then they also just went cutthroat. Like, your marble and the other guy's marble, sure, you can knock each other off the course if you want.
Yeah.
But it's going to make you that much slower, and you guys together may not be able to beat the game if you spend too much time competing like that. And so I think the way they implemented multiplayer and the fact that they took the time to and gave you some of those bonuses of, hey, take this more difficult route and we'll give you a couple of extra 1,000 points.
Right.
But it might be slower or it might be faster. And you had those choices to make. Made this game even more replayable and even more fun to play socially. And agreed. I was super glad that they chose a well thought through 2-player experience.
I wish we could have played co-op. It's one of the few NES games that include co-op, like even Mario, you know, it's like just take turns
at the same time. Co-op. Right. You're playing.
Yeah.
Together, not just swapping off controllers.
Yeah. And I mean, there are NES games that did that, and I know, and don't shoot me. I don't have names right now of games that did it, but this one is so simple that it's like, you have to do it. Hey, come play this game with me. Come over here, dad or brother or sister. 100%. And then you just sit down and troll each other. It's great.
And you know, that's exactly what would happen if we tried to play this game together. Yeah. Forget high scores. Forget completing the level. I would just be knocking your marble off as often as I possibly could.
Don't touch my marble.
Aged.
So we've talked about the fact that we primarily played it on NES. I know some of our viewers took the time to find online emulators that were the actual arcade version, whatever else. But I do think that when you have these types of games that were sort of designed for an arcade experience and we're going back and playing them in retrospect, there's just something that you're always going to miss out on. Something about standing there having a trackball and the actual controller. Was that enough to make this game like difficult for you to get into, or how did you feel playing it on the NES with the D-pad? And
I thought it was a really great port. I didn't play the emulated version of the arcade, so I can't 100% say that it's like better, and I wouldn't say that because, like you said, I think you have to be standing there, and I could probably find one here in Austin. We have a lot of like arcade places. So maybe I'll get to play that one day. But for me, it was a no-brainer to jump right in. Like, I know that I didn't have the trackball, and that's probably a game changer, to be honest. But I thought it was extremely easy to start it right up. It's a no-nonsense game. Like, you start it up, and it's just ready to go. And it's just like, all right, put your name in. Let's do this. And there's no Yeah.
I do love that they ask for your name beforehand, not just at the end where you're putting in a high score. That's super great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a, like a small thing, but yeah, it picks up easily and it's really obvious what you're doing. It would, if they weren't as careful to like keep the graphics simple and make this 3D looking environment really like clear as to elevation and changes. And there were a couple places where like, what if you could fall off onto something, or if something was a level that was interactable or not, weren't unclear, but for the most part, it was really obvious what was going on the stage. And I think that's super hard to do with a game like this. And so I'm glad they kept it simple. And because they kept it simple, it's super easy to pick up and play.
Yeah. And along with that, I will say, I think the art style, the decision behind the art style and the graphics, and I don't know if we've described it really, but it's like a grid looking thing. I said it was Tron. It looked like Tron. That's silly. I don't know. But it's grid based. And that was intentional, obviously, because with lines and a grid, you can pull off the illusion of depth and right. a 3D space on a 2D plane. And it works so well.
And they did a really good job of using, you know, variations in color. Like it's pretty much simple colors, but the
true, yeah.
You know, hey, this thing is at an angle and so it's a darker color. And the lines, they were able to really clearly communicate what was expected. And that made it fun. In fact, it made it especially confusing when they took one of the levels and kind of flipped it on its head, which was sort of fun. The fifth level, I think, instead of going from top to bottom, which you now have adjusted to and you have like gravity on your side, you're starting at the bottom of the map and having to go up these ramps.
Up ramps.
And go in the complete opposite direction after you've gotten used to this sort of like downward flow. But because the layout is so clear, it's still easy to just figure out, oh, this is the same thing, just up. And it, like, even the gimmick works better because they made the game so clear.
Yeah. And that's what I was worried about going into it. I was like, isometric, that's a good choice because how else are you going to do this? But then I was like, yeah, but how are they going to indicate this slope goes? It's even hard to describe because there are so many optical illusions that exist, you know, with like lines and directions. I was like, I'm going to get confused. But no, not one point did I get confused.
No. And they did a good job of making it clear what were enemies and what you were supposed to do. And that's hard to do in something that's just as simple as this. And so you could tell it was really, really well thought through. There were some things you had to kind of figure out, like you touch certain walls and it bounces you off. And, you know, there was some trial and error. But once you kind of get it, you get it. And it's communicated really clearly. They did a great job with that.
And I mentioned the music earlier, but on that same front, I mean, it's yes, it adds to the stress, which speaks to the difficulty, but it's good music. Like every stage has its own unique music, which I really appreciated. If it was six stages of the same tune, it would feel like it was 12 stages. You know what I mean? Like
absolutely.
Music can really affect your mood playing a stage or a game even. So the fact that you beat one stage, you have that satisfaction of look how much time I saved. And then in the next stage, the music turns on and it's a different vibe.
Right.
And it almost matches the color scheme too in a weird way. Like
you talked about some of the like sound being a little bit revolutionary, but this was a big deal. They actually used some new technology to do the sound and music of this game. So it was the first game to use an FM sound chip. This Yamaha DX7 synthesizer. What that allowed them to do is it created the music in real time so that it was like perfectly in sync with what was happening on the screen. So it's not like,
that's interesting.
Right. It allowed them to do a little bit more ensuring that like sound effects and like the energy of things were happening with the game instead of the Tetris approach of like choose a cool upbeat background tune and just, you know, throw it on repeat.
Sure. Well, I couldn't have described it that way. I didn't know what it was, but it worked. So sure. Yeah. New technology. And again, 84, that's early. That's really early, I think, for a game like this to come out, or at least a game that's this unique to add all of those factors to it. So for today, for someone today wanting to play this game, I'd say it's not too big of a hurdle. I mean,
no,
especially if you can hook up a trackball. Like,
right. It came out on a million systems. So whatever system you have, if you choose to play it on that actual system, you know, you can probably find a cart. If you're choosing to emulate it, you've got a plethora of options, and you know, it's on everything, and it's really, really easy to pick up. And because of its simplicity, doesn't have some of the normal aging problems that other games that came out in this time did.
And there was a planned sequel for this game that actually didn't come out. It was called Marble Man, Marble Madness 2. And the idea behind that, Mark Cerny was like, okay, kids like characters and superheroes. So let me add, you know, some sort of hero aspect to it. And so we made another game, had some more mechanics like flight and visibility was in there. But I think when they went to like location test it, no one was interested in it because there were like cooler games coming out that was like absorbing all the hype.
Oh, 100%. This was right game, right time. You know, this is yeah. An arcade game when like the novelty of it is just there, in the same way that like some of the recent like fairly simple phone games were able to be popular just because you could play it on one hand and it was portable and it wouldn't make a great PC title, but like still sold a million copies because it just fit what people were trying to do in gaming. This is definitely has a harder time once you are competing against, you know, more complex, more robust games that came out later. And we talked about it as a genre definer, but you don't get other marble-based kinds of games, you know, the Super Monkey Balls and some of those things that you talked about for years later.
Final thoughts.
At the end of each and every one of our episodes, we determine if a game gets New Game Plus status, which is our general thumbs up or thumbs down, whether you should pick up a copy of this game and play it or pass on it. Usually, it requires 2/3 of the vote to swing one way or the other, but since it's just two of us, we've decided whenever someone's out of town, that's Dustin or Kenny, because I've never missed an episode.
Whoa.
It has to get unanimous votes. So both of us have to give New Game Plus status. Dustin can't give a vote later. He's not here.
That makes it sound like a really, really high bar, and I guess it kind of is. But ultimately, we just want a majority decision, and when there's two people, you can't have a majority. So,
But it also does mean, because with most games, we're like, okay, one person cannot really get vibe with it. But here, we have to both really like it. So, Kenny, we'll start with you. What did you think? What do you think about Marble Madness?
Yeah, it's... I'll be relatively quick. It was a really well-made game when it came out. Because of its simplicity, it's still pretty playable today. Doesn't have a lot of hurdles from going back and playing it successfully if you want to try it. And it's fun. It's short and it's difficult, so not everybody is going to be into it. But because of how easy it is and how short it is, I think the bar of like whether someone ought to try to play it is lower than other games would be. Like, I don't know, for a 14-hour RPG, I'm not going to like recommend, hey, everybody go out and play this game unless it's just super revolutionary. But this one's fun. I felt myself getting into it as the music counted down and I was learning it. There was this stress and this, you know, euphoria of success. And I enjoyed myself. And I think it's a game worth knowing about and worth playing, even though it's not going to take you super long to either beat it or realize that you can't. And so, I'm going to say New Game Plus for me. Go back and give it a shot.
Okay, that's one vote for yes. I'm going to say this game is so easily accessible and it has aged so well in my mind that you can't not play it. It's so short And yes, you will spend more time on it than someone who's very good at it because of the difficulty, but that's the fun. I think the balance of difficulty is well executed. And because it's so short, okay, let's say you got to level 4 this time. That's really good for you. It's a personal best. You died. Okay, well, now you know the first 3 levels and you can do them faster now to get more time for level 4. That's such a brilliant design. I am geeking out over some of the decisions this guy made when he was making the game. And it's on console without quarters. You can play as much as you want. And all of a sudden, it becomes a speed game. I never really considered this game or heard of this game in the speedrunning realm, but it absolutely is a great speed game. The speedrun record is 2 minutes and 40 seconds. You have to play this game. You have no excuse. Get a copy of Marble Madness in GP. That's 2 votes. That means that Marble Madness NES or the arcade cabinet, if you have it, is New Game Plus certified. But what did you think?
Well, let's see. Hookshot wrote in, said, short and sweet is how I'd describe Marble Madness. It takes practice to get the controls down and find the right path to maximize your time, but I can't pull out my NES without doing a quick playthrough of this gym. I've been playing it on and off for over 30 years, and I still can't beat the final level. One of those games that defines NES hard and deserves NGP status.
Nice. It's totally one of those games that you can just pick up and put down in 10 minutes and get some enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, I think that summarizes the feeling of the game really well. Challenging, but like classic and worth picking out and playing and you know, being willing to play again and again. Garlisle, our wonderful director, said, Marvel games are a genre of their own, and I honestly love them. Good ones carry a variety of similar strengths, creative and diverse levels, tightly responsive controls, and allowing not just for enough skill to clear, but to really master them. Marble Madness has all those things, which is remarkable. Not just for its age, but because there wasn't even other games to improve upon or learn from. The only thing it lacks compared to the rest of the genre is length. What really surprises me, though, Marble Madness is recognized as the father of this genre, but it would be nearly 2 decades before anything would emerge like it. Gaming would wait until we had good, solid 3D to try again with this formula, and it has had several amazing successes. Super Monkey Ball, Marble Blast, Road to Valhalla, and some others. And they owe it all to this 6-stage short gem.
Drop the mic. I never thought about that. The 20-year gap. It's like, okay, make a better one. And then people were like, nah, I ain't trying that. Yeah.
Literally. Until they had full 3D. Well, technology can't do better, you know, or at least we can't do better in a way that people are going to want to play until you get full on 3D. SNES's Life wrote in and pointed out that as a child, he has memories of this game and remembers it semi-fondly, but that he didn't do very well. He says, if anything, the shortness of the game only having 6 levels means if you do go back, it likely won't take too long to beat. I struggle on my decision because although I liked it, I just don't think it's worth hunting up a copy. So I guess no NGP for me.
Okay, I was wondering if we would get a no NGP in there because I want to hear someone's I want to hear their opinion on why it shouldn't be. And so the argument there being it's just maybe not worth it. Like, yeah, it's good, but it's like not one that you have to play.
Yeah, I think that was his summary. He also, I kind of cropped some of his thoughts. He pointed out Super Monkey Ball and some of those other newer games are probably better. And so it was just sort of is it worth it specifically to get your hands on this cart and play? And for him, it wasn't. Old Man Matt said that he played a lot of Marble Madness as a kid and that it might have been the first game that made me throw a controller at the TV. That's a hallmark of a game.
That's one you'll remember. That's one your parents will never let you forget either.
He goes on, luckily NES controllers are kind of underpowered against a furniture-style CRT. I think this game is actually a perfect mix of fun and hard. It isn't a challenge to control, but is to control it well. The length of the levels means that much of the gameplay comes from repeated failing, but for some reason it feels addictive more than frustrating. Finally, the quality of the arcade port on the Internet Archive makes playing at zero work. This is a definite NGP status for me, even if you only spend 20 to 30 minutes playing in a browser. Astral Soul, Mike also wrote in, said that he liked it overall, played it as a kid, and same things. It's difficult, but can be learned if you practice it enough. So,
okay, it's one of those games then that the community seems to just kind of be all on the same page with. I don't want to speak for anyone, but it's just so simple, and I think that that makes it very playable.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys, for writing in. We always appreciate it. On future episodes, if you want to leave your commentary on any of the games of the week, you can email us or jump into Discord and leave a comment in our commentary section.
But for now, we're going to be putting Marble Madness to rest after getting New Game Plus status, and we're going to find out what we're going to be playing for the next 7 days. I have the power here, and I'm very, very excited. I usually am on the receiving end of this, but we're about to find out what we're playing. Randomizing now. It's a Konami game.
All right.
It came out in 2001.
Huh.
You want to guess the platform?
Nope.
Okay. It is part of a very, very large and well-known series. It is a handheld title. It is a 2D side-scrolling style game.
2D side-scrolling handheld in 2001 by Konami. I should be able to figure it out just by, in a big title. I'm sure people have already figured it out by those clues, but I still have no idea.
Well, if you haven't, we are going to be playing Castlevania Circle of the Moon.
Wow. You weren't kidding when you said it was a popular franchise.
I know, right? So I've never played this one. It looks familiar to me, but that's probably because I've seen it at AGDQ, speedrun of it or something. I'm excited. I love Castlevania.
What console? You dropped the title without letting us know what we're
Game
playing.
Game Boy Advance.
Oh, GBA.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, that makes GBA. Sense for 2001. I just wanted it to be clear.
Yeah. So the graphics are actually really good. They look great. And I love the GBA. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I know you're a big Game Boy Advance fan. So,
and the last, speaking for Dustin here, the last time we played a Castlevania game was Symphony of the Night, and he over 100%ed it. He got literally everything. So
it was one of his favorite games we've played yet that was new to him, I think. I don't know. Maybe I won't speak for him, but I remember him really liking it.
So pick up a copy of Castlevania Circle of the Moon for Game Boy Advance and play along with us. Talk about the game with us in our Discord server. You can go to ngppodcast.com, click join us in Discord, and take part in one of the best communities out there.
If you like what you're getting week after week with retro gaming content in the form of this wonderful podcast, you can join the crew at patreon.com who support us on an ongoing basis. Like our producers who go above and beyond in giving generously to the show on a regular basis, Anton and Ben, Dear Baby, Garlisle, who is a director-level supporter, and we appreciate so much, Kevin, Corey, Maxima, Zach, Zion, and we do want to welcome a new patron this week, Carrie. Thanks so much for supporting our show, guys. And for those of you who have supported our show and are curious about when you are getting your next bonus content for hitting that last stretch goal, we just got word from Dustin a couple of days ago that he is pretty much done crafting our one shot for the D&D one shot we're going to record for you guys.
And yeah, so, it's going to be good.
So we don't have a specific date, but that will be out just around the corner, and we're looking forward to giving you some fun, different kinds of content. So looking forward to it.
You can find us on our social media. That's Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, as well as YouTube. Links are in the show notes. Listen directly on any podcast provider of your choice. Make sure you are subscribed so you are the first to get new NGP episodes. And while you're at it, leave a kind rating and review. We would really appreciate it. This episode was edited and produced by our friend Tom Tate. Join us next week as we play Castlevania Circle of the Moon. Until then, I'm player one.
I'm left player.
And this has been New Game Plus.